Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Command Show. I am so excited about this month's show. I have the esteemed pleasure of having one of my favorite people in the fire service, one of my favorite people on the planet, Joe Castro, retired Chief Deputy of Operations for the Los Angeles City Fire Department. He has graciously accepted the invitation to speak with me today. I'm really excited. He's a mentor of mine. He's a luminary in the fire service. And I'm excited about sharing his wisdom with you. Before we get into that, I want to talk about a couple of things to kind of set the tone for this show. As you know, we always talk about the NIOSH 5. And again, it's lack of or insufficient incident command, accountability, communications, lack of SOGs or failure to follow your SOGs. And the biggest one is risk assessment, really not having a good size of what you have. That's number one. So when you learn about, we're constantly evolving on our knowledge of this information through line of duty deaths. That being said, I really like the work that's being done by some of our friends across the country to analyze the NIOSH 5 in a different way. What are the human aspects? Things like experience level, training level, things like auditory exclusion, which we talk about in our classes, tunnel vision. These are all parts of why the NIOSH 5 come into alignment. Now, you don't have to have a line of duty death for the NIOSH 5 to be present. The more of them that come into alignment, the more likely you can have a bad event. But you could have the NIOSH 5 come into play with close calls. Certainly, almost every significant close call you read about will have the NIOSH 5 present, if not all five, but at least the majority of them. Injuries, exorbitant fire losses, losses to civilian life. The NIOSH 5 is not just for line of duty death, but we always have to analyze this data the best we can. The other thing we're doing is I'm proud to announce officially here that we have a brand new textbook coming out. It's called Mastering Fire Ground Command, Calming the Chaos, and it's the textbook. And my co-author is Brian Brush, who typically co-hosts this show with me. As always, he's across the country teaching and being really busy, so he couldn't join us today. But I wanted to announce to everybody, this book is coming out officially at FDIC International next month, April of 2024 in Indianapolis. We're really excited about it. And it's a very comprehensive book. It's, I believe, 560 pages. And it's FESHI, NIMS-ICS, FireScope, NFPA compliant. Which means we really covered the entire spectrum of incident command. And it's not an East Coast book. It's not a West Coast book. It's not just a book about the incident command system. For those of you who've taken my classes online or in person, it's that on steroids. And so we're proud to have this book. The foreword was written by John Norman from FDNY. However, a significant piece right behind that was written by today's guest, Joe Castro. He writes about the history of the incident command system, how it evolved. He lived through that evolution in his career, and how it was implemented at the Los Angeles City Fire Department, and how LA City uses ICS day to day. And it's a model for how I believe the rest of the fire service should consider using it, or at least learn from aspects of it. In our classes, we talk about it's not one size fits all. It's not one size fits all. If you're a one station or two station, 2-0 staffing, you're not going to have the same resource levels that Los Angeles City Fire Department or Sacramento Metropolitan Fire District would have, or FDNY, obviously. But you can still use elements of what we teach in this book. They're very universal, regardless of the size of incident, regardless of the size of your fire department, regardless of the incident type. We really get into the aspects of size up, of bridging the tactical gap, how to see the fire ground from a strategic, tactical, and task view, and how to get ahead of the incident power curve, and many other aspects. And the nice thing about having Brian Brush on board with this new book is that it's very victim-centric. We don't have to have either command that serves and considers the safety of the firefighters, or command that is aggressive and prioritizes the victim. We can have a mutually beneficial incident command philosophy that benefits the victim who are there to serve and save, and our firefighters who are there to lead and protect. They're not mutually exclusive goals. So I just kind of want to set that tone as we bring in our guest for today. I love this man. He's given me so much in my career and to so many. He's one of those guys that we always ask, is it leadership natural or is it learned? And if you look at, if you listen to Joe Cash, you're going to think it's natural. And a lot of it is, but a lot of it is learned. He's a student of the fire service, even to this day. He's a student of incident command, and he continues to be an instructor and luminary across the country. So without further ado, Joe, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you here. It's an honor.
Oh, thank
and thanks for being with me today.
A kind introduction. I don't think I could have written a better one myself. I appreciate it.
Well, like we talked about, your career has spanned several decades. You're enjoying retirement, but you're still a huge resource to a lot of us around the country. Can you kind of talk about your career and how you rose through the ranks through the LA City Fire Department, and also your direct witness to the evolution of the incident command system from its early inception to the implementation of LA City to its refinement along the years, along the decades, and your overall approach to it? And that's a big question, so I'll chime in and we'll go back and forth. That's kind of the theme for today.
Absolutely.
So wherever you want to start would be great.
First of all, I was hired in 1978. Ironically, September 11th, 1978 was my hire date with the LAFD. I was just turned 19 years old right out of high school. And I met a woman or a young girl, young woman who his father was an LA City firefighter. And I went to visit him for the first time, the new boyfriend. And he was an engineer at a task force down in South LA. And he asked me if I ever, what I wanted to do for a career. And I had just graduated high school. I had no idea. And he asked me if I ever thought about being a firefighter. And I said, no. He showed me the LAFD schedule and said, I only work these green days, you know, 10 days a month. And invited me down to lunch. And I went down to lunch. And it was a real active task force down in South LA. And that was my first introduction to the fire service. And the competitive nature of getting hired was drastically different then than it was now. Long story short, is 7 months later, I was in the LAFD Academy as a 19-year-old kid who basically knew nothing about the fire service other than they rode in big red trucks and smashed things with axes. But that began what I consider a privileged career working for a fabulous fire department, and ultimately would take me to places all over the world to teach and learn from firefighters everywhere. I was fortunate, like most of us, to have a lot of very strong mentors early in my career. I stayed a firefighter for about 4 years, and then I promoted to apparatus operator, which is the driver of our truck companies. And I stayed an apparatus operator for about 5 years. I worked in one of the most active stations in the city, Task Force 33 in South LA. And then I made captain with 9 years on the job. And I stayed captain for 17 years, excuse me. I made captain two relatively soon, which is a truck captain. And I loved it. And I truthfully had no intention ever of going any farther. A truck captain was my career choice. And I just thought, this is the life. And there came a time when I felt myself getting a little lazy, to be honest. And I had a decision to make, which was to maybe transfer to back down to South LA to get re-energized by these young firefighters and kind of get off what I considered a lazy portion of my career, or take the BC exam. And I took the BC exam. Fortunately, I was successful, and I was thrust into that position. And that gave me a whole nother view of leadership and requirements. And at that point, I had some great assignments. I worked in Battalion 3, which is by USC campus, for about 3 years. I was the commander of our tactical training unit, which that was right about the time the NIMS compliance training became required in the aftermath of the attacks on 9/11. And so that kind of began my comprehensive teaching career with different fire departments. We taught not only firefighters, but police officers and city managers and for the entire LA region, the 32 cities that kind of surround the city of LA. At that point, I was Then after that assignment was over, I was given the command of Battalion 5, which is Hollywood. And I had about roughly in my mind about 7-8 years left on the fire department before I retired. And I was thinking I would end my career there. And then in a moment of lack of clarity, the LAFD, the fire chief of LAFD, reached out and said he wanted to bring me in and run the Emergency Services Bureau at that time. And
this is a big segue. So before we go to that, because I want you to take a chance to regroup, because this is a big segue. You mentioned 9/11. I want everyone to know about a friend of mine who passed last weekend, Captain Randy Gross from Sacramento Metropolitan Fire District. He passed from 9/11 related cancer just last weekend, and he and I responded to New York on Task Force 7 from California, as did the LA Task Force, LA City Task Force. And Randy was a canine specialist. He was a luminary in that world, especially in California, getting it off the ground before 9/11. And he just passed. He's a man of faith. He knew he was going to heaven to be with Jesus, and he was at peace with that. But he gave his life in that, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention that in this particular show, because the chief just mentioned 9/11. And that was really a pivotal time in the fire service for all of us, for America, and also for the incident command system and NIMS. And so as you were thrust into this new role, and so everyone can understand what chief deputy of the Emergency Operations Bureau is in LA City, can you kind of explain what that is and how the structure works and who's underneath you and what the scope is, how many stations?
Sure.
And how it is today.
It's, to me, it's one of was when they called to ask me to do it. I thought this is the most coveted job in fire service, in my opinion, in the country, to be in command of the emergency line functions of the second largest department in the country, basically a little over 3,000 people, segregated into 14 battalions, 4 bureaus. It also is in charge of the arson counterterrorism, the resources that protect both LA Harbor and Los Angeles International Airport, our Metropolitan Fire Communication Dispatch Center. And I had my direct reports for the 4 geographic bureau commanders. And since I skipped several ranks, I went from DC, I skipped the assistant chief rank, the deputy chief, and went to chief deputy. I maintained a extremely open line of communication with the ground pounders, the mission workers, the captains, firefighters, the battalion chiefs. And I like to think that's partly why I was chosen for that position, because I had established a level of operational credibility. And now it was my job to kind of mirror that with an administrative ability and the all important part of balancing politics and operations, which was a big part of the job. But exactly, again, you know, yeah, being able to speak on behalf of over 3,000 firefighters, 1,000 of which are on duty every day, responding to about 1,400 emergency responses every 24 hours, was absolutely the capstone of my career. And I felt very privileged to be in that spot.
Yeah. Yeah, and your influence in the Los Angeles City Fire Department continues to this day. Your influence internationally, abroad, as well as nationally, is still prevalent because of not only your incredible experience and exposure to all that, but like you said, your credibility. It's hard to have both the ability to stratify, I'll call it, those three categories of emergency operational credibility, good leadership, but then understanding the political aspects of your job at that level, because it is a lot very political at that level too. It's not just about, you know, running calls. And how many state? I know LA City now has 106 fire stations. How many did LA City have when you were first put in that position? Was it 103 or so? Or did it grow at all?
You know what? It's been within three or four stations of that my entire career. There's been some that shut down and some that were added and some that were changed from a task force to a single engine, but it's been about the same. We've added a significant, in my nearly 40 years of service, a significant amount of ambulances. But the number of truck companies has stood right around 46 to 48. And the number of engines has stood about the same for my entire career.
Yeah, that's great. And it does to this day. And so when you were a battalion chief compared to when you were chief deputy to today, because I know you're very connected with the department still, you've helped us with some training. The approach to the fire ground, the use of the incident command system, can you speak to how that's evolved over the years from those late 70s when ICS was first created to today? And is it more the same than it was, or is it more different than it was back when it was began?
Well, it's I would say the fundamental aspect, if you were to look at it empirically, you know, written down, would be kind of similar to its origins. We know the early to mid 70s is when they began composing it. I was hired in 1978, but it was primarily the origins were to deal with wildland fires. We know that, and one of the big changes was when it became kind of an all risk concept of incident management, meaning we adapted the areas underneath the operations section to meet a variety of tactical challenges, be it a MCI, be it a hazmat, be it a urban search and rescue incident, a high-rise incident. We began to adapt it. But again, even then, as a young firefighter, confused a little bit about its value and application, it was viewed back then initially as kind of a system for chiefs. It was this confusing organizational chart that we really didn't incorporate the elements of it that address exactly what you alluded to at the beginning of this show, which was kind of the converging entities of operational safety and efficiency. And it's funny, but and those unmistakably, undeniably cannot be separated. You know, if we can design a very safe operation, we can hold people back, 250 feet from a burning structure and have them lob heavy stream appliances in through the windows. And we know that chances are in that type of operation, we're not going to injure anybody. That would be a safe operation. However, our job, and I always refer to this as the kind of the Starbucks concept, and that every firefighter we know has been in a coffee house ordering a cup of coffee, and some well-meaning citizen shoves them aside and puts that credit card in the hand and says, "I'm buying this firefighter's coffee for him." And I always ask people when I teach, why are they buying you that coffee? Are they buying you that coffee because you're going to ensure your safety tonight at that fire when their children are in there burning or in danger? Or are they buying it because they know you are rightfully going to rise to the occasion and crawl through that window and save his children? And that's the efficient part of the operation. And truthfully, one of the things that I always thought that a solid working knowledge of the incident command system combined with experience, which is what gives you judgment, will result in an operation that is efficient and safe. And I always include safety because safety was extremely important to me. I've been to fires where LAFD members were killed. I had their bodies in my hands. I've been to hospitals and had to explain to a concerned wife or family member why this young firefighter is going to be going through 6 months of skin graft surgery. And frequently they would ask me, what happened? Why? And rightfully so. I'm accountable for that. I was my final position. It was my people that supervised that. And to be able to say that that the risk, even at such great cost of this funeral or this this hospital, was warranted, because that's the mission of our job. Or conversely, I've evaluated plenty of NIOSH reports and held them up to that same five filters that you talked about, Chief. And I come to the conclusion that that risk was upside down, that they shouldn't have been that aggressive. And to me, that's what ICS does, it's a system that allows you, under the circumstances, to come to the best informed decision about how to have an operation that is both safe and efficient, based on an unimaginable number of inputs that you are expected to make in short order, with lack of information, misinformation, death paradox, all these other things. How can you design a system that's going to convince you that you made the best decision? And to me, the answer has always been ICS.
Yeah. And, you know, Chief, I love how you said that. I have a saying, ICS never put a fire out, but it organizes the people and resources that do, you know. And you mentioned the inputs and the injects, and you mentioned experience and wisdom. That's not in ICS. ICS is a tool to organize, and you have to be adept at using it, but it doesn't take the place of additional training and experience on everything from building construction, fire behavior, strategy and tactics, and a myriad of other knowledge, skills, and abilities that could go on forever. But when you mix it together and you hone it and you use realistic training like we do with our Calm the Chaos program, then you can really take strides and take people who oftentimes in today's day and age, Chief, like you said, you were a captain for 17 years before you became a chief, and you were a battalion chief for quite a while. We have captains who are captains for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, maybe, and then they become battalion chiefs. We have battalion chiefs who are battalion chiefs for 4 months and then become operations chiefs. And it's no discredit to them as individuals. It's a result of this leadership pandemic, this vacuum we have in the fire service right now, that's on a whole other level that we've never seen. So ICS is a tool to help you not be a tool. That's what I like to say. But unfortunately, unlike LA City, there are thousands, literally thousands of applications of the incident command system around the country. And to your point, its inception was through large scale wildland fires. The proper application to a house fire, an apartment fire, a commercial fire, a strip mall fire, a vehicle accident, a hazmat leak, that rapid, agile application of it is just as effective. It's just a different compressed time frame. You mentioned compressed time frames and inputs. I tell people you have to make life and death decisions possibly with limited information in a compressed time frame. That's not easy to do. It's a learned skill and mastery of all these dimensions of knowledge, skills, and abilities, and practice of those is what's going to make the incident commander and his or her team effective. And so can you speak to kind of that evolution that LA City went through of being, to this day, a very aggressive urban fire department? It still is. It was before you came, and it is now. How was it received? How was it modified? And how was it applied to structure fires? Because you had lots of sets and reps. There's other fire departments that may only see one structure fire a month, where you're seeing multiple a day throughout the entire city. And maybe speak to how Don Anthony was kind of that influence and that season in the fire department.
Well, and Chief Anthony was an iconic leader in the fire service. He was back then it was called the commander of the Bureau of Fire Suppression and Rescue. It was before we had our chief deputy system, but he essentially, it was the same job that the chief deputy, the commander of emergency operation now does. And he was, his nickname was the Doberman. And his nickname was the Doberman because of the depth of his bite. He was a iron-fisted commander. And I remember talking to a firefighter or a captain who was a young firefighter when Don Anthony was a captain. And he told me something that always stuck with me. He goes, when Chief Anthony was a captain, he was the best in the fire station at every single thing we did. He goes, he was the best at hose. He was the best at ladders. He was the best handball player. He was the best cook. He could outfight anybody. His memory was photographic. And, but more importantly, he outworked everybody. When we'd come back from 4 days, we'd come back and we'd be talking about stories of this, the water ski trip we went on, the surf trip, the fishing trip, the hunting trip. And we'd come back and the first lineup after 4 days, he'd have a list. And that list would have 10 things we were going to accomplish this segment. And they were all fire related. And you could tell he composed that on his 4 days. And they said, so one of the things that, and one of the things I've always thought is, not every one of us can be the best handball player or the best cook, but the one thing you are in control over is your work ethic. And that guy made it his life's chore to outwork everyone. No one would ever outwork him. And we can all do that. We can all make that our goal. But one of the things that he did as a in that those early phases of ICS was he began to adapt it to, like I said earlier, the different types of incidents. And therefore, it had more applicability. It wasn't just for this once every 2 year major huge brush fire, even though the failures at those brush fires is why it was developed. He made it for hazmat, for structure fires, for all variety of different incidents. And then most importantly is he required all of his chief officers, there's over 80 chief officers in the field in the LAFD, he made it mandatory for them to use ICS terminology. And therefore, at every incident would have an incident commander, every incident. And again, the flexibility and scalability has always been very misunderstood. A lot of people feel that it's only for these big incidents. And when it became the law of the land, when the NIMS component, the ICS component of NIMS became the law of the land, that was another thing that was very misunderstood around the country. And I got that. For me, it was easy to adapt to because it was essentially our system. However, and one of my favorite fire departments in the country has always been Phoenix Fire Department. And that was attributed primarily to the brilliance of Chief Brunacini. And I would go back there and teach at an annual conference. And they had an incident command system that was completely different. And they were really put out that they were going to be required to adapt to the system that we had used. And it wasn't a bad system. It was a very good system. And as you and I have talked numerous times, Chief, that our thought is that all we want for these fire stations is to have a plan. You have to have, and whether you're an engine captain first on scene or whether you're a battalion chief or a deputy chief rolling on a major emergency, the bottom line is we want you to have some type of plan that you can refer to that's going to ensure that you're comprehensive, that you don't leave things out, that's impervious to stress, and that's going to result in a safe and efficient operation. However, as the evolution of ICS evolved in the wake of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the failure of a central system that responders from both all risk, law, fire, allied agencies, NGOs, there was not a single system that in the catastrophes of the 21st century, 9/11, Katrina, all these other big things, it pointed to the need of resources coming from local, state, and federal and international. And the only way for that to work is to have a central system. Now, again, that all still points to these huge incidents. And one of the things we found out is be very naive for anybody to think that you could learn this system. Let's say you're back in Chicago Fire Department and you're going to learn this new system because you still want to receive those NIMS dollars. And that you were then, after learning this system, you took ICS 100, 200, 300, 400, 700, and 800. And now you've learned the system. And it's a jumbled mess of books and papers. And to think that you're not going to think about it again or practice it. And 3 years later, you're going to get popped out of bed because a big bomb has gone off downtown Chicago, and you would be effective. That's lunacy. It's not going to happen. And what we decided was that the only way for you to become efficient at these big incidents is for you to practice the ICS system daily. And everyone then began to see the value of this at routine incidents. I mean, even the smallest incident, an engine and a car fire, you know, how, and again, the scalability and the flexibility is what allows you to considerably scale it down, but still understanding the tenets of executive level ICS. You know, the one thing almost everyone uses now in executive incident planning is that thing that the Coast Guard developed called the operational planning P. But you can look at that operational planning P and you could equate the steps, each step of the dispatch, assumption of command, incident objectives, strategy meeting, all these things, which the fruition of that operational planning P is a composition of an incident action plan, a formal incident action plan. But you could scale that way down and apply every one of those steps to what every good BC in this country should be doing at a two-story single-family dwelling fire. And by you practicing that, it's going to make, first of all, by knowing the executive level system, it's going to make you much more effective as an ordinary fire ground operator. And conversely, as a very good fire ground operator at an ordinary fire, you are going to be that much more
effective. Amen to that. And that is really the whole, our whole philosophy through our training and through how we're trying to provide incident command system training in the urban rapid type 4, type 5 environment. The one alarm, two alarm incident, the house, the room and contents, the kitchen fire to the well-involved house or apartment fire to a multi-alarm structure fire and beyond. And I wrote an article probably going on 10 years ago called, it was basically the article was about the difference between ICS in the wild end, large scale urban environment versus the day-to-day type 4, type 5. So type 1 through 3, county, state, local, federal level, 1, 2, 3, versus type 4 and 5, single alarm, multi-alarm, and or a structure fire versus a large scale 100,000 acre plus campaign fire. And those differences are what helped drive our curriculum about, look, an operational period in a large campaign fire is 24, maybe 12 or 24 hours. On a structure fire, it's about 20 minutes because that's how long your bottle is going to last on your back. So that's a compressed time frame. When you look at the SCBA and the impact it has on communications, very different than a large campaign fire. The full ensemble of protective equipment, PPE, is very restrictive, and it makes it much more difficult to account for people, to communicate with them. The nature of the workplace on a large campaign fire versus a structure fire, where you can't see your hand in front of your face at times, versus a large scale fire that's outside predominantly. And so through these differences, that was one of the bridges that we made to help people understand that you have to change your application of ICS. This, to say it's scalable is kind of an overarching philosophy, and it's true, and that's what you learn in those ICS 1 and 2 and 300 classes. But how do you apply it? What does scalability look like? Why is it important? Why? Because there's a lot of folks, and oftentimes over the years, we're talking over 10 years ago now, I'd run into ICS purists who would really have a hard time applying an ICS to a house fire, because to them, hey, I'm on a type 2 incident management team. I'm on a type 1 incident management team. I've got a division that's multiple miles long. I don't need a division on a house fire. It's one house. My last division on my last, you know, type 1 fire had 300 homes in it. And so it's like, look, it's a different world though. You don't get to triage a structure fire in a local neighborhood with your fire engine on a Tuesday in your normal shift. You have to go inside that building, assess the risk, assess the potential for civilian life, add resources to that, communicate and account for them in rapid fire. And it's going to be over before you blink an eye. However, that doesn't mean that ICS can't be utilized and very effectively. It's just going to be utilized in a much tighter, compressed, efficient manner. And And that's kind of why we developed what we call pre-templating types of incidents, different structure types. What would a house look like, a two-story house? What would a commercial, an apartment, a garden apartment, a center hall apartment, a high-rise, a strip mall? What would those? How would you template those before you ever have the fire, just as a starting point, to rapidly organize it with ICS? So I didn't want to interrupt you there.
You know, one of the most common questions I get teaching ICS all across the country used to be, well, how do you know how much of this system to implement at a small incident? And I said, listen, the answer to any question you're ever going to ask me about ICS is simply this. It's based on the size, scope, complexity, novelty, and duration of the incident. And no two incidents are the same. So if you're going to ask me, do you need an operations section chief at this specific fire? I'm going to tell you it's based on the size, scope, complexity, novelty, and duration of the incident. If you were to equate ICS with a number of chronological steps that have to be undertaken, each one of those steps has, depending on the complexity of the incident, another five different subsets. And that's why you see, like, that's the truly, Chief, the brilliance of your system is your system for that first arriving captain that you designed to help people not only through the testing process, but to help them when they're plastered in that jump seat, first on scene at a complex and potentially evolved normal incident. You designed a system to get those young captains through that. And it's a brilliant system. I've seen it work in testing environments. I've seen people utilize it in real life. But really what that system is a method for somebody to execute components of the ICS system and to make sure they don't miss anything. And if you were to take your system of management of that initial IC, because that's kind of another thing, it's the art, is for that initial IC incident commander. We know that we build ICS from the bottom up, and that we give a lot of flexibility traditionally to that first in officer who has to make these judgment calls at a not commonly occurring or something that's bumped that commander out of their comfort zone because of size, scope, or complexity. And so we design, everybody has these little systems. And in LA, we actually copied what Brunicini called the essential elements of command. And we called ours the standard of command. And we added and enhanced, but we plagiarized about 75% of what he did. But again, it was a method to allow somebody to execute the art of ICS. You know, I always think that when people come out of those classes, they go, okay, I'm ready. And I say, no, you're not ready. You know the system, but the art and whether you're going to execute it properly and to the level that your mission workers deserve and expect is based on some of those intangibles that you talked about, the ability to make those good judgment calls. And that is dependent on a million different things, your experience, your previous fails, all of these things we learn. You know, we talk about NIOSH reports and what a wealth of information those are, because everyone that's in existence is because there was arguably a very bad outcome at a national incident. And understanding it's not disrespectful to the firefighters that were either injured or the department that made the mistakes. The only disrespectful part is for the firefighters across the country to ignore those lessons learned. And you can take one of those NIOSH reports every day, and there's literally hundreds of them out there now, and apply tenets of your system or the standards of command for LAFD uses, and apply each step by step. And invariably, you'll find things that were missed. And hopefully, the lesson is that if you are in that same situation or a similar situation, you will not be sucker punched like that poor guy who saw it for the first time. I always maintain all of our policies and books in the LAFD are because something went wrong. And if you roll on scene of a novel incident, you do the best you can, but there later on, people prove that we could have done better over the fullness of time. That results in a policy. And again, the only crime
that's exactly
doing that same mistake
right.
twice.
I totally preach that. I learned it from you. I've learned it from other mentors, Brunicini being one of them. He was a huge influence in my career and my life. I love that man. My brother taught me this because my two brothers were on the job a lot earlier than I was. I came along 15 and 18 years after them, and they were in the fire service. In 1972, my first brother started his career, and my other brother started in about 75, 76. And I grew up in that fire station in 1 square mile Carmel. And I remember in the early 80s when ICS first came along. And my brothers had a saying, there's new, and I'm sure others have used it and have coined the phrase too, but there's no new mistakes. There's just new firefighters making old mistakes. And it's just the old saying, the fire service changes one retirement at a time. And shame on us for not learning from the past and not diving in and gleaning every ounce of bone marrow out of every NIOSH report so that our fallen brothers and sisters do not die in vain, that we don't just develop a policy, but we know their name, we know their face, we know the details of those incidents. We glean that out and we change not only policy, but we change our methodology, our training, our mentoring, our officer development because of these events. Otherwise, we're doomed to repeat that history.
Absolutely. I was very privileged to have an incredible staff of chief officers that I could assign projects to. And I could take a NIOSH report and hand it to them and say, I want you to read this. I want you to find applicable LAFD incidents where we've made similar mistakes. And I want to see a training bulletin out of it. And then I would say, I don't care when that first iteration of the training bulletin, make it as verbose and long as you think is necessary. But understanding that the nature of firefighters is if they sent me a 40-page training bulletin, that some of the message would get lost. But I would tell them that that you can make it as long as you want and comprehensive. But the bottom line is the last page, I want to be the 10 things that must happen at this incident, knowing that the good captains and good chiefs out there, that's going to be the page they were going to tear out. And that's the page that was going to be included in your their go book in their sedan or the front seat of their apparatus. And they did. I had one, he was a captain, actually. He produced an amazing document after the fire up in San Francisco, the split level descending house where we lost a couple SFFD brothers. And right after that, we had a descending hillside home that I had two of my best captains get caught in the same quagmire. And I said to myself, how can I let this happen without? And then we made a mandatory process for a descending hillside home incident that now is part of a legacy that all captains became a policy. And again, that's the art of ICS. And it is part of ICS because if you don't have the judgment of being able to size an incident up. And, you talked about risk profile, and that was another concept that was maligned when it first came out. But there is nothing more important. I mean, I would watch incidents of LAFD members hanging it all out on a cheap auto parts store at 3 o'clock in the morning on 5/8 inch plywood, cutting a hole with direct flame impingement on the sheeting, where I could show you data that suggests that in about 4 minutes, that plywood is not going to hold 50 pounds and you're going to fall through and die for what? The funny thing is about risk is rarely have I come across any incident, either LAFD or across the country, where in the really tough incidents where we got people hanging out of windows and 2 o'clock in the morning, we got fire racing through an apartment house, I have never, ever seen an incident where I had to, or a commander had to tell firefighters, you need to get in there and go rescue those people. That, across the country, that's when we're at our best. But it does worry me that level of aggression sometimes isn't applied to a loser structure. And when we get in our dress uniforms in LA and we march down Temple Avenue to go to Our Lady of Los Angeles Cathedral, because we're putting one of our brothers or sisters in the ground for a fire that they we shouldn't, that's a heartbreaking thing that we need to learn about. And again, ICS is a method to ensure that that the risks are appropriate and relevant to our strategy, you know, mirrored with our strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. And the on the flip side of that coin, like you said, you rarely do you have to poke and prod them to get to take action. If you have to usually jerk the chain and to hold them back. It's about smart action, right? It's not about being safe as much as it is not taking unnecessary risk. Don't take unnecessary. This job is risky. This is a risky job. It's more risky every day.
Yep.
And it's not about not taking risk, because if that was the case, don't be a firefighter. Just don't respond. Just don't go. But smart risk, calculated risk, and doing it again in a compressed time frame with limited information, that's hard to do. However, if we take a decentralized approach, which ICS allows us to do, it sets the table for this, where our officers, our company officers, our incoming chief officers can take bits and pieces of the incident through groups or divisions and be our eyes and ears, be our risk managers, be our accountability officers, and safety officers in those different components of that one building simultaneously. Instead of one safety officer orbiting, checking for gloves and eye protection, you have multiple embedded in the incident who are constantly looking at that and also pushing them in, saying, hey, there's a tactical opportunity right there, guys. Let's do VES in that window right there that maybe they didn't see because they were so focused on the front door. And getting that victim profile. Hey, who do we have? Where are they? How many of them? And where are we going? So it's not just headlong into a situation, but headlong into the right window, into the right door, knowing what we're going after. That's the layer on top of ICS that we're providing with our with the new book and with training, is how to assess and communicate those little nuances that could make or break whether or not certainly we get hurt, but more importantly, whether we make a save or not, because that window is slamming shut rapidly to make a rescue that's, or of a civilian who's actually going to survive the incident.
Unquestionably. One of the things I would lecture to a lot of assistant chiefs and higher at big incidents, and I would, as the commander of emergency operation, I was bound by city charter to respond to all major emergencies anytime we have over 15 companies working in the city of LA. But arguably, I get in late by the time they wake me up at my house in Redondo Beach and I drive into LA with my department car. A lot of stuff has already been done. And what I would do is I would step back and watch. And if I didn't have to take command, I didn't have to, but I would kind of look back and try to make some decisions on what's happening. And I would query these assistant chiefs and deputy chiefs, hey, what do we have going on here? And I would caution them over and over again, you're too wound around the tactical axle. I need you to understand to be looking out. I need you to have that 20,000 foot view. But when I say that, sometimes it would be misconstrued as that no one should be around the tactical axle.
Right,
and that's the farthest thing from the truth.
Oh,
we
absolutely
need those captains to be wound around tactics because that's what they're doing. But they need somebody, and they don't need someone to follow them around that same axle. They need someone to elevate themselves a little bit more and look at the incident, the totality, and make sure everything is being done correctly. And that might, like you say, it might be a decision to pull people out. It might be a decision to realize a tactical opportunity and to be more aggressive than going and get something done. But it's a fascinating, complex thing, the command system. And it's dependent. It's so different depending. You know, I come from a department that had 1,000 people in the street every day, and we could bring almost all of them to the same incident. We did sometimes, and that's a bit extreme, but it's kind of funny because when you are resource rich, you frequently, those great fireground captains frequently will make decisions independently at an incident that make those commanders look good.
Exactly.
They do. You know, I'm sure that when I was running fires at BC, some of those great captains in South LA says, you know, Joe seems to be struggling out there at the command post. I'm just going to go ahead and take this line to this door and put the fire out. And then people are patting me on the back later. Nevertheless, the goal was always, for me as a chief officer, as it related to the ICS system, was to, when I rolled on scene and I took command of that incident, for them to breathe a sigh of relief that I was there to help, not to intrude, not to legislate, even though we did have to fix things and right the ship frequently. But nevertheless, there was I wanted them to have the same feeling that I had as a young captain when we heard Chief Anthony get on scene, which right. is, hey, the man's there. He's looking out for us. He's making great decisions. And it's going to be nothing but good that he's here, rather than, we know that it happens frequently in the country. Oh, no, we got Chief Smith here.
Chief has
he's
going to
start
scene.
Screwing everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Chaos.
So,
that's great. You know, as you were talking about that captain, it makes you look good. I was a young incident commander in my first year, and I had a car wash fire in the middle of the night. And one of the captains on the rescue company, which was newly formed, and that role of that company was to kind of not freelance, but, you know, but had the freedom to roam throughout the incident and plug holes and look for tactical opportunities and execute at will. What within reason and within accountability of either the division or group that they're working in or the incident commander. And I was ready to pull the pin on this car wash fire. I was, hey, look, it's 3 a.m. It's clearly unoccupied. We've searched it. It's into the structural members. It's not looking good. We're not making headway. And Brian Rice, who was the captain of Rescue 21, who then became a battalion chief, operations chief, and is now the president of the California Professional Firefighters. He was the captain on Rescue 21 that night, and I was the incident commander. And I was ready to pull the pin. And he goes, I see a firewall in here. I see a firewall in here, and I think we can hold it here. We won't go into the defensive space where the roof's probably going to come in, but we can hold the line here and save this attached smog shop, the whole mechanical back end of the car wash, and the office space above. And I went, great, fantastic. And that's where one of those pivotal moments as a young incident commander, I think this was in 2005, when I learned, oh my God, with the right people, with the right training in the right place, you can really impact the outcome of an incident at the tactical level. Like you said, in the tactical space, I call it the tactical gap between the workers on the hose line who's got smoke in his face and the incident commander outside having bonbons and sipping mint juleps at the command post. There's that space where the battle is really won or lost. And when Brian identified the firewall and the tactical opportunity, I said, sounds great. And we didn't go defensive. We went into what I called a combination strategy. Hey, stay out of this area, but we're gonna be offensive in this area. So this area is offensive, this area is defensive. And I have some great footage of that fire where you see simultaneously elevated master streams coming into the defensive side of the facility and offensive 2.5 shooting out the top from the offensive side where he was holding the line. And he assured me, hey, we're not in danger. We're in the mouth of a hallway. We're okay. And that decision saved a multimillion dollar facility and that business. It was remarkable.
You know, we, a lot of time as commanders or fire officers, we want a clear line drawn in the sand for all decisions. Yeah. And remember when the department was that first developed a risk profile in the wake of firefighter Tarver's death in Phoenix was Phoenix. And one of the things they did, which your initial blush, and I don't blame them at all, was they made it mandatory for a captain to declare offensive or defensive right at the site.
Right.
You know, this is an offensive or defensive fire. And there was in that period, a clear line drawn in the sand. Defensive fire, we're staying outside. Offensive, we're going inside. Well, as you just demonstrated, there is no clear line in the sand. There sometimes is ones that were a little bit defensive and a little bit offensive. Sometimes ones that were offensive, you know, so there. And I always refer to commanders, the people out there at the suburban, the ICP, that don't have a face piece on. They're not worried about the rookie. They're not worried about rig placement. And having the courage to either listen to those fire ground commanders And you're still accountable, whether you tell them, hey, I agree with you, stay in there. Yeah, if something goes wrong, you're gonna live with that. But having the courage to listen and to either, based on a number of different inputs that you had, your relationship with this great fire ground captain,
trust.
The information he fed you, was that matching what you were seeing and hearing? Yeah. Did it sound logical? And you had the courage to then let him do kind of a hybrid combination of the strategy. Or also, it takes courage to, I hear what you're saying, but I'm telling you, it's not that's matching not what up I'm, with what, that's I'm, not seeing. What I'm seeing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yep. And I've had both of those comments, but it does take courage for that commander to, but again, the big thing is if you have some type of a system, which I had a system for every time our dispatch center notified us that we had 10 minutes on the incident clock, 20 minutes on the incident clock. And I remember when I first started as a deputy chief and I would watch the commanders that were running the incident behind the Suburban, when they would receive that message from the dispatch center, hey, you got 20 minutes on the incident clock. And they would just pick up the mic and say, Roger, put the mic back down. Yeah. And I would say later on, I would ask them, you know, what went through your mind when you heard that? Well, you know,
I had too much going on.
They couldn't quantify. Yeah. Yep. And I would say, do you know why they're telling you that? Because it's still about the time temp curve. It's they're telling you that thing has been burning for 20 minutes. And realistically, I would like you to step back and I would like you to evaluate 5 or 6 things to determine if your situational awareness is still accurate. Do you need to develop an alternative strategy? And for me, I just developed a quick thing, you know, first of all, is the fire bigger or the incident worse than when I first got there? Do I have all resources reconciled? Do I have a communication plan? Do I have a way to talk to everybody? And I went through 4 or 5 different things that would allow me to say, you know what, I got 20 minutes on the clock, but I'm still good with this strategy. Or if I, you know, those things that I talk about, they paint a red stripe on your rear end. And it's like you mentioned, you know, the if you don't have resources reconciled and you don't have a good communication plan, and this thing is bigger than when you first got there, and it's been burning for 20 minutes, you had better have an answer to what you need to do to fix that. That's what you get paid to do. Otherwise, if you can't do that, if you can't make a decision and make a judgment call, you might as well just kind of leave the incident command post, throw on your turnout coat, and go in there and mix it up on the roof or inside.
Just put your hands on a hose line.
The value that you have.
Yeah, it's being a task level worker. You're not doing your job. And that's, you know, up until the past 10 years, I would say, maybe 15, has the America, the nation, really elevated the importance of training for incident commanders, you know, besides just, I'll get your cert, get your ICS 1, 2, 3, but actually realistic training. And it, a lot of it's been simulations. But now with our program, we're doing hands-on incident command training. They are at the back of the buggy. There is smoke pouring out of the building. It's theatrical because we don't want to have unnecessary risk with carcinogens. But the smoke provides the fog of war needed. Everyone's in full PPE with SCBA. They're talking to rails. They're pulling hose lines. Their saws revving. And that adds that extra element of reality and realism. So that when we do hit them with a 10-minute par clock or a 20-minute par clock, they're already here like they would be. And if they ignore it, it's because they haven't been trained. And to them, that par clock notification is white noise. It's just another thing I got to deal with. I don't want to deal with it. Instead of seeing it for the tool that it is. And then doing a training timeout in the midst of those scenarios. There's crews inside doing searches. They're finding mannequins. They're pulling hose lines. And then we say timeout on the radio and everyone stops. And then we ask the incident commander, why did you ignore the par clock just now? What is your span? Who's on division in division alpha? What do you see? Are you still in the right strategy? Is this still a life-saving priority right now? Or are we in incident stabilization? Okay. Do you have adequate resources? Do you have them assigned appropriately? Do you remember who you have in staging right now? And they look at you with these eyes like this because it's not a simulation in a classroom. It's a realistic training scenario.
Yeah.
And it's really awesome to watch them evolve quickly.
No doubt. The kind of the national advent of people building up the mock Suburbans, the back of the incident command post, And then having a very educated and astute green cell that throws those injects at them in real time. And then combining that with developing simulations that teach that judgment, that those injects come at a time and in a manner that's going to add stress to the situation. And it's an invaluable experience. It's a no-fault environment. The only people that die are those, you know, people on the screen. And the other thing too is that the person that's in the hot seat or the multiple people that are in a hot seat are learning a lot, but people that are sitting back and watching are learning just as much. And in the advent of declining amount of structure fires across the country, that is the way to gain those sets and reps to become effective and to become an operator or a commander has that like trip hammer level of efficiency that those great commanders all seem to
and
have.
I think the combination of that kind of training and then again, literally outside hands-on smoke machines in your face, air breathing, go engines pumping is the next level. And then also realizing that the modern incident commander should take a mission command approach or a decentralized approach like the military. The military doesn't have a general running a battle. They have a lieutenant colonel running the battle and segments of the battle while they're back at the command post, which may be miles away. So the military says, look, we're going to have, and they use the term subordinate leaders. I never like the word subordinate for anything, but they're going to have leaders in what basically is the tactical space. Taking those chunks of the incident, the third floor, the Charlie side, the roof, the RIC component, the medical component, and say, look, you are tactical. I need you to step back from the work. If you're the roof division on a structure fire and you have even just your own truck company, you can have your head in that hole. You need to step back with your radio in one hand and looking at maybe with a tick camera or at least looking at the big picture, us counting for your crews, seeing what the smoke's doing, seeing what the crews are doing beneath you, listening to what the radio's got going on. And that's in the next, that tactical next. But like many truck officers, you know, we all like to have our hands on the tools. And so there's that evolution that all truck officers must go through where they have to be tactical. And the hard part is when you take a department where the staffing isn't adequate, it's 2-0 staffing, 3-0 staffing. It's really hard for that officer to step back and be tactical because they have to put their hands on the tools just to stretch the initial hose line, for example. So they are head down in the task level. That's why maybe the next company or the third company, an officer becomes Division Alpha with those crews working for him or her early on, not waiting for the chief who's still 10 minutes out, the second chief who's 10 minutes out. But hey, let's get this thing. Let's stay ahead of the curve on this, fellas, because it looks good now. But to your point, what's it going to look like in 10 minutes from now? You know, and that's a big piece of it. You know, as you're talking about the science and art of incident command, I kind of look at ICS as the ability to read music. You could read music, and if somebody reads music, it doesn't matter what they're reading. It's to them, they see the notes and they understand it. But the ability to, that doesn't mean you can play the piano. You know, you have to learn how to play the piano or the tuba or the trumpet, the guitar or the violin. And the incident commander has to not only read music, you have to run those different parts of the orchestra, the strings, the horns, the piano, percussion, and bring them all together. It doesn't mean you have to go out and blow the horn. You have to go out and play the violin, but you better know how to read music and how to bring it all together. Whereas the tactical leaders need to know how to play the violin. And they need to know what when things are out of tune and they're not in tune and we're not at the right tempo, we're not on the same sheet of music that we should be. And so I think that's the extra added element that ICS doesn't provide. It teaches you how to read music, but doesn't teach you how to play the instrument. Each instrument is different. An engine's different than a truck. You know, if strings are different than winds. And so that's, I think, the nuance that people realize. So understandably, historic, like you said, When people who don't understand the incident command system enough and only emphasize its limitations, oh, it's too big, it doesn't solve problems, it's not agile, it doesn't really have tactics and strategy, you know, and that's where our training comes in, where realistic training, the green cell stuff comes in, where you overlay and you start playing music together, and you realize, you know what, this house fire, we've played this song before. Okay. Does it mean it's gonna be exactly the same? No. Does it mean that should we still plan for contingencies and unknowns? Absolutely. But we have played this song before. And so that's the predictability through training and the application of ICS, the use of resources, the typical tactics that'll be applied, whether it's VES or vertical vent or what have you. That's where our ability to remain ahead of the incident comes in. Those things combined create that efficiency that you spoke about when we started the show, of that efficiency. Can we do it in a timely fashion to execute the mission successfully or not? Are we going to save them or are we going to get hurt ourselves? Those are the two poles, right? Are we going to do it fast enough and smart enough to get them out? Or are we going to do it slow enough and stupid enough to get us hurt? And that's kind of the sliding scale. So this stuff, I could talk about this all day. I don't want to take any more of your time. You have your brand new, beautiful grandson with you. But anything to close us with, Chief? I mean, we could sit at your feet all day and listen to the wisdom come off of your lips. But anything?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head that ICS is a system of incident management. It does not compensate for rudimentary firefighting skills. It's still about those firefighters that get to the incident quickly and safely, that lay the lines, that throw the ladders, have the ability to, you know, those great engine captains that have the ability to root out the seat of the fire, those great truck companies that cut the holes, those great search and rescue teams that pull those people out, adherence to personal protective equipment, SCBAs, and having those skills. ICS enhances and complements that, but it does not replace it. You could be the best fire ground operator, ICS compliant in the world, but unless those companies are trained, but when you have a trained company that their rudimentary skills, their fundamental firefighting skills are top notch, they have concise standard operating guidelines, those individual companies, and then you enhance that with a great fire ground ICS commander, that's how we have those crews that we're so proud of and that do amazing things at incidents. And ICS certainly doesn't replace that, but in the proper sequence, it is the answer to most of the complex questions and fears we have on the fire ground. So I appreciate you. I love you. You know that. And I'm a big believer in your system and the good that you're doing throughout the country. So it's very much a source of pride to me to be associated with you, Chief. And I appreciate the opportunity for today.
I'm humbled by you saying that. I obviously feel the same. I love you. I tremendous respect. Your influence on me has been abundant, and you'll never know how much so. Thank you for your time, especially with your family obligations today. And congratulations again. For those of you who, just as a reminder, Chief Joe Castro is one of 33 luminaries in the fire service who were gracious enough to contribute to our new textbook, the one that Brian Brush and I wrote. It's coming out next month at FDIC, Mastering Fire Ground Command, Calm the Chaos, the textbook. 560 pages, a lot of which are legends like Chief Castro and others throughout the entire United States, coast to coast, who share their wisdom, share their experiences, their case studies in command. It'll be available at FDIC and at fireengineeringbooks.com relatively soon. And if you have any questions or want to schedule training that we're talking about, realistic hands-on, either incident command training or leadership training, please email me at info@trainedfirefighters.com. Thanks again, Chief. You're the best. Appreciate you.